small plane crashes near the Idaho-Montana border in the Clearwater National Forest. That's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates-Carney. A wildland firefighter is found alive after going missing yesterday in the Bitterroot National Forest. And Northwestern Energy's CEO maintains the purchase of 12 hydroelectric dams is good for Montana and good for the company.
A small home-built airplane has crashed in the Clearwater National Forest near the Idaho-Montana border, killing the pilot. The Clearwater County Sheriff's Office says a helicopter crew with two Bear Air helicopter of Whitefish, Montana, spotted the wreckage today near the Blackhead Mountain area west of Lolo Pass. Crews on the ground confirmed the pilot had died. No one else was on board. The pilot's name is being withheld while family members are notified. The pilot contacted another airplane this morning and reported there was oil on the plane's windshield. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton says the pilot was unsure if the plane would make it to its next planned stop in Helena. The Federal Aviation Administration says the airplane was a single-engine Lance Air Legacy, traveling from Richland, Washington to Baker, Montana.
In other news from around the state, a Bitterroot National Forest firefighter who went missing while hiking to a site of a small lightning-caused fire about 10 miles east of Hamilton has been located. Forest Service spokesman Todd McKay says the man was a member of a hand crew that contained the fire on Saturday and was going back yesterday for mop-up work.
Sometime during that hike in, he was separated from the crew, got behind hiking in, indicated that maybe he was having some problems with one of his boots and he would catch up. They went ahead, and once they got to the fire location, waited for him. When he didn't arrive, they tried to reach him on the radio. When he didn't respond, they then went back along the trail and tried to locate him and could not. So exactly what happened, how he got behind and lost in that hike, those are questions that we'll just have to wait a little while to get answers to.
About 50 people, along with an aircraft, searched for the man yesterday and today. He was spotted this afternoon walking along a forest road several miles from the fire. McKay says he was taken to the hospital and his condition is not yet known. McKay says the man's name has not been released because some family members have not yet been notified.
State forestry officials say while the mountain pine beetle epidemic has passed its peak, survey results show it's not yet over. Department of Natural Resources pest management specialist Amy Gannon told the Board of Land Commissioners today more than 526,000 acres of pine trees were infested with the beetle in 2013. Gannon says that amount is still significant as the insects continue to leave stands of dead trees in their wake. The most active outbreaks remain in the southern part of the Bitterroot National Forest and in the Big Hole area in the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest. Since 2000, the epidemic has spread across more than 6 million acres, or 23% of the state's 26 million acres of forest, on private, state, and federal lands.
Glacier National Park officials continue their investigation today into the shooting incident between an out-of-state hiker and a bear on Saturday morning. Park Management Assistant Dennis Germain says there's evidence the bear was wounded in the shooting, but declined to give further details. There's no word on what type of handgun was used.
It's legal to carry a gun in Glacier National Park as long as it complies with state law. It is illegal to discharge a gun in Glacier National Park unless for the purpose of health safety.
Officials say the encounter occurred at 9:30 in the morning when a 57-year-old man from Texas was hiking alone through the park.
Initial investigation indicates that there was a lone hiker on the Mount Brown Lookout Trail, which is on the west side of the park, and a bear charged him from an area below. And again, our initial investigation indicates that he deployed bear spray and then discharged a handgun. Don't know if it was a black bear or a grizzly bear. We do know that the individual had no injuries.
The hiker returned to the trailhead to warn other hikers and notified park employees. The officials immediately closed Mount Brown Lookout Trail and began monitoring the surrounding area.
And we are asking park visitors to report any bear sighting. And routinely we ask park visitors to report any bear sighting, and specifically in this instance, any injured bear that someone may see.
Park rangers and bear specialists began their search for the wounded bear by hiking the trailhead and taking a helicopter to the summit of Mount Brown. Germain says it's unclear at the time what will happen to the bear when and if it's found.
Record coal exports in recent years are helping the U.S. appear to be making more progress on global warming than it actually is. But they may not be helping the planet. As America gets greener and produces more energy, it has sent more dirty fuels abroad, saddling other countries with cleaning up the exported pollution. This fossil fuel trade threatens to undermine President Barack Obama's plans to curb global warming. But the administration doesn't want to figure out how much coal exports are contributing to global warming. It says the impact is small. U.S. coal consumption declined by 195 million tons from 2008 to 2013. About 20% of that coal was exported. Exports are expected to grow with global demand as the U.S. further cleans up its power sector.
Researchers are using blood samples from osprey to determine whether pollutants from industrial sources are contaminating the bird's food supply along Montana's Yellowstone River. The three-year study of the fish-eating birds of prey is being conducted through the Yellowstone River Research Center at Rocky Mountain College. Rocky Associate Professor Kayan Ostover says that the project will allow scientists to compare the health of the Yellowstone to other rivers across the country. Researchers so far have collected blood samples from osprey in 63 locations. Ostover says that data will be analyzed in the coming months.
The Montana Public Service Commission earlier this month held 2 weeks of hearings on Northwestern Energy's proposal to pay $870 million to purchase a dozen hydroelectric dams. Northwestern CEO Bob Rowe says the dams and their power plants would provide customers with reliable power at steady prices for decades to come. The plan could increase Northwestern's customer electric rates by 6.5%. The PSC, its staff, and others had tough questions for company officials. One economist suggested that if he had to choose between Northwestern's expected price of a constant $55 per megawatt hour and the open market prices, which could vary between $30 and $50 per megawatt hour, he'd personally prefer paying those variable open market prices. Northwestern's Bob Rowe doesn't see it that way.
As a state, my response has been there, done that, and it hasn't worked out terribly well on either the electric or the natural gas side. If you think about the way utility service for owned assets is priced, it's essentially as if the price that a customer pays is actually based on the accounting that the utility does, and the accounting is audited. So we talk about the rent versus own comparison, and it makes a lot of sense. Over the last few years, we have purchased power just from PPL alone at the total cost of about $1.5 billion with a B dollars. And that was renting. We didn't build up any equity doing that. With the opportunity to own the hydroelectric assets, we are building up equity. And because customer prices are charged based on the original cost minus depreciation, as the plants are depreciated from an accounting perspective, price to customers goes down over the long term. Add to that the benefits from essentially getting rid of fuel price risk for this set of assets, the benefit of the diversity in the portfolio, protection from the market, protection from future environmental regulations. We think this is a very, very solid and compelling direction.
PSC attorney noted that Northwestern has agreed to pay over $300 million more than the book value of the dams in question. Is that true? And if it is, why?
Well, these assets are now on the market, and as everyone in Montana remembers, under the deregulation statute, they were sold out from being regulated assets to being market assets. So PPL, the current owner, is not a regulated utility in Montana. They are a merchant. We had to find a price that was acceptable to them and was, again, in our view, least cost, least risk for our customers. So the starting price is a market price. When we compared that option, purchasing the dams, to building, for example, a new gas plant, to remaining on the market, to building other kinds of facilities, this was the least cost, least risk, long-term asset. But again, very importantly, PPL is not a regulated utility in Montana. Any other acquirer would be either a merchant like PPL or could be a utility serving another state, in which case these assets could be dedicated to serve their customers.
If Northwestern does buy these dams and the plants, could you promise that Northwestern would never, ever sell them again?
I hope that as a state, Montana has learned the lesson from supply deregulation. We are in the business of being a utility. We consider ourselves stewards of essential infrastructure dedicated to serve our customers. So from Northwestern's perspective, the answer is yes, absolutely. These assets would not be sold. Add to that the law passed in 2007 that allows Northwestern to again own generation includes a whole series of protections for customers, including obviously strong Public Service Commission review, prices based on the cost of production, and that the assets will be dedicated to serve customers, and that they may not be removed again from public service without the commission's protection. So, again, all of that points to my very strong belief that these assets would be dedicated to serve our customers on prices based on the cost of production permanently.
What if the PSC, Mr. Rowe, comes back with a decision sometime this fall that says in some way or another, okay, Northwestern can buy, but we can't allow you to recover all the money you'd like at this rate structure, if you will. Is that a deal breaker?
Well, we've tried, in fact, to move the annual revenue requirement down. And let me give you some examples there. First of all, as you know, the acquisition includes CurGam for 1 year. Since we filed the case, we have more clarity around the future of CUR, and the Confederated Tribes have a right under a license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to acquire CUR basically in fall of 2015. So we took out some of the costs associated with CUR. We will write PPL a check for $900 million, and if we don't do that, they have no obligation to close. We are requesting that the Public Service Commission allow us to rate base $870 million. And that simply is the figure. We have no ability to go back and renegotiate with PPL. They have plenty of other opportunities to deal with these assets. What we've tried to do from there, though, is make adjustments that help lower the annual cost. And that has to do with the ratio of debt to equity, the depreciation life, the rate of return on equity, various other adjustments that we've proposed as part of this filing, again, to manage the overall near-term cost to customers.
What sort of condition, generally speaking, are these properties in?
They're in very, very good condition. Actually, we had our board of directors meeting in Three Forks just last week and took the board out to see the Madison Dam, and that's the oldest dam and one of the smallest. Two things impressed all of us. First of all was the condition of that, again, the oldest dam, and second, pride and dedication and expertise of the employees who operate it. We put on 18 witnesses approximately in the Public Service Commission case, and that included veteran employees who now work for Northwestern Energy, who grew up, they called themselves as river rats when Montana Power owned the dam. They led our due diligence team. They'll be responsible for the operations of the dams. They were in good condition when they were sold by Montana Power to PPL. They have been well maintained by PPL, including some very significant investments that will provide a lot of long-term value. So we like the condition of the dams. We have a lot of visibility into the work that will be needed to do over the next few years. And one of the really impressive things that our hydro team has done while we've been focused on the case in front of the Public Service Commission, they've got to the point where we are essentially ready to begin operation if we're successful in getting a Montana Public Service Commission approval, go out and get financing and can begin operations right away.
Northwestern Energy CEO Bob Rowe, as always, thank you, sir, very much.
Thank you very much.
And in the forecast for our listening area, west of the divide should be mostly clear through tomorrow evening with lows tonight in the upper 40s to mid 50s and highs tomorrow in the upper 80s. In central Montana, it'll be partly cloudy tonight. There's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs in the upper 80s. In southwest Montana, look for mostly cloudy skies through the evening and tomorrow with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows tonight in the 50s, tomorrow highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power. ¶¶
international dialogue over the size of the contribution that humanity has been making to climate change, a small dissenting group of scientists and politicos have come to be labeled climate change skeptics, a term they have chosen to avoid the alternative label, climate change deniers. The choice of the term skeptic is an attempt to hang on to scientific credibility, since science and scientists, by professional code and practice, are required to be skeptics. That is why scientists around the world and across the centuries have regularly gotten into trouble with dogmatic religions and totalitarian political regimes. Because scientists are trained to question all factual statements until there is overwhelming empirical evidence in support of them, scientists have often been labeled heretics and traitors, and either banished to gulags or painfully and publicly murdered. Authoritarian governments and religious institutions seeking to protect the status quo against change sought to silence all skeptics, including scientists, and convert us all into true-believing sheep. But these days, our climate change skeptics are not skeptics in that sense at all. Instead, they are employed by the most powerful economic interests in the nation, joining the already powerful to maintain the status quo and prevent changes that might impact the wealth of well-entrenched elites. Now it is coal, oil, and gas interests, along with energy-intensive heavy industries like electric and natural gas utilities and chemical industries, who are funding the climate change skeptics. Those powerful industries fear that restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions will cut into their profits and wealth. These contemporary climate skeptics follow in the footsteps of the discredited tobacco skeptics and asbestos skeptics, for instance, who responded when those industries needed scientific-sounding evidence that smoking was not dangerous to health and tobacco was not addictive and, of course, asbestos did not prematurely kill people as a result of lung disease. Ironically, the scientific method, because of its requirement that overwhelming empirical evidence support any factual claim about reality, provides the disguise in which climate change deniers can pose as scientists. Despite the popular view of science as discovering facts and eschewing theoretical speculation, science heavily relies on theories that relate various aspects of physical reality to each other and then draws hypotheses from those theories. Then comes the hard part, testing those hypotheses by investigating those predictions about things we can observe and seeing if the hypotheses are confirmed by reality. Note that theory, hypotheses, and predictions are all part of the scientific method, as is empirical analysis confirming the hypothesis and lending tentative support to the theory. Scientists are skeptics in the sense that they emphasize avoiding the error of asserting that something is factual when it may not be. Scientists would rather keep saying, "We don't really know," and reject proposed explanations, even when one of those explanations may actually be true. That is, scientists are professionally committed to saying, "We don't know," in the face of limited or questionable evidence until the evidence is overwhelming. Climate change deniers, on the other hand, hang out on the fringes of climate science research, looking for anomalies that conflict with previous findings that have been confirmed by empirical evidence. That, of course, is a productive place to work, since all important anomalies ultimately have to be explained for a confirmed theory to continue to be trusted. On the other hand, using the remaining loose ends and unavoidable areas of uncertainty to reject a large body of empirically confirmed scientific work is appropriately labeled denying, in the sense that it uses whatever areas of uncertainty or ignorance continue to exist to simply deny what we do know. It imposes an unscientific rule of perfection to deny large swaths of scientific knowledge. In the world of science, we never have perfect certainty. Explanations of phenomena are never facts in the sense of being understood at all possible levels of observation. In science, the harder we look, the more complex processes and systems appear to be, and the more we need to learn to have a complete and reliable picture of physical reality. Scientific exploration and discovery never ends. But that does not mean that we know nothing, or that we cannot make good practical choices at both the most minute quantum levels as well as at the most expansive cosmological levels. We face what are still profound mysteries, where we are still at the totally speculative level of trying to propose systematic ways of understanding our universe. That does not, however, keep us from exploring other planets, using an increasingly complex set of amazing electronic devices, and making use of incredibly detailed and effective medical procedures. Our everyday lives demonstrate that we do not need to know everything in order to safely carry out some very complex but productive and valuable tasks. That is as true in dealing creatively with climate change as it is with most of the other practical problems we face as a nation and as responsible citizens of the world.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtbr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.